Welcome back to Work in Programming. This week, I am here with Dan Moore. Dan, would you mind quickly giving yourself a quick introduction?
Sure. So I am a developer. I've been a developer for about 20 years. I've been a CTO. I've been a contractor. I've been an employee, a startup founder, and currently I'm a developer advocate for a company called Fusionauth.
And so I guess 20 years, that's quite a tale. So like typically I go and want to like learn about how you got into programming, your first moves, and then we can kind of breeze through the periods, whatever, however you think that goes. I think breaking it up into like, like specifically like developer advocacy as like the end point, cause that's where you are now. And I'd love to hear about being a CTO, cause that sounds really interesting. And I know you have like a pretty great blog, and and I'd love to hear about the start, actually, if you want to jump into that.
Sure. I think everybody has an interesting origin story, it's always interesting to me how people got into software. So I'm really excited to have this opportunity. The first time I really remember thinking, wow, computers are awesome, was I actually worked at an insurance company. My parents had a small insurance brokerage, and they had to do mail merge every month to send out these notices that people's policies were expiring. And when I came into the scene, I was in eighth grade or whatnot, I was in eighth grade, about that old, and they were cutting and pasting these, and like someone was going through each letter and changing it to add the address and the date of the expiration, everything. And I just said, I think we can do better than this. And I'd done a little bit of mail merge on my own, like just exploring around with WordPerfect WordPerfect. And there was a database, a primitive database called Notebook. And so I set that up and basically just had, you know, the address and all the interesting data, all the interesting fields. And then I did mail merge, and it was a lot of work to set up, right? Obviously to enter that data into that database. But once that happened, the magic of something that took hours and hours for someone to do manually happening in 30 seconds, a minute, was just really amazing to me. So I thought, wow, this is really cool. I wonder what more there is. And that was kind of my first real programming experience. I guess you'd call it programming. It's not really a language, but yeah.
And mail merge is email, or is that actually like physical letters? Oh,
this was actually like you do the merge, and then you print out the letters, and then you'd fold them and put them in, you know, and I think we did end up like printing labels too, but it was manual work after that too. So it was not email at that point.
I think it's great. Like you built like a CRM almost for physical mail.
Totally.
Way before its time.
Well, and the other people in the office were not really computer savvy folks, and they were just thrilled. They were tickled, right? That they had now had this thing that they could go, and instead of having to keep physical files, they were able to just search and say, okay, here are all the people whose policies are expiring in 2 months. Awesome. We can reach out to them. We can do other things. So.
And you did this in eighth grade. So what was the transition from there to like your first, I guess, what you would call your career?
Yeah.
And we can, if you have any other interesting stories, cause that's really cool. At eighth grade, I imagine you were doing some cool stuff in high school.
You know, honestly, I kind of step back. Like I did that in eighth grade cause my parents owned the company and like made me do some kind of work for them for minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And then I got a job doing non-computer stuff in high school. And decided to go to college to study physics, but I went to a liberal arts college because I wanted to be a writer. And I got there, and the first couple of years of physics were really cool. And then we got to like the lab stuff and some of the less straightforward physics, and that was less cool, less interesting to me. And I ended up doing a research experience for undergraduates, kind of an internship over the summer where I helped write, it was physics education. So I was writing software to help people understand physics concepts. Anyway, long story short, I ended up getting an internship right after college with a company, and this was in 1999. It was a small web consulting company in Boulder. Mm-hmm. And I was there for 3 weeks. And after the third week, the boss called me in and said, hey, would you like a job? And I took the job, and it was great because super smart people working on just, I'm biased because this is where I started, but I always suggest people, if they don't have like a firm idea of where they're going, go work at a small consulting shop, because if it's a consulting shop, you'll get this breadth of experience. You won't be working on the same code base year after year, which can have its frustrations. But if it's small, you'll actually get the chance to make a difference, right? If you go work at an Ernst & Young, you know, you'll bill a lot of hours, you'll make a lot of money, but you might not be moving the needle. Whereas if you're working for a small company, you'll know who the CEO is, you'll know who the, you know, you'll have regular visits with your bosses and whatnot. So
yeah.
Anyway.
What kind of like projects and work were you doing at that consultancy? Like early on, you said this was, I forgot the year that you mentioned, but yeah. So like what exactly were you doing in terms of like the projects that you were doing for people's websites, or was it?
What would you say you did? It was a web consulting company. So,
okay.
And this was 99. So there was kind of a gold rush going on, but specific project I worked on a Yahoo clone. So it was kind of, somebody had this, it was a startup. I worked on the, briefly on the Churchill Downs website. So we helped with the Kentucky Derby back then. What else did I work on? I worked on vitamins.com. So
I love that. That's like the .com. That's the definitive spot for vitamins, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where it is now, but that's actually a good lesson I learned at that small consulting company on that Yahoo clone project. I was on a small team, didn't have a ton of budget, and the lead fell ill. And so they were looking for someone to step up, and I was fairly new to the company still, but I stepped up and worked like a dog. I worked, I think I topped out at 96 hours 1 week working, and we launched, we were successful in terms of launching. And at the end of the day, they kind of had a little small launch party, and they called me up and said, "Hey, Daniel, thank you. And here's a t-shirt and a six pack of beer." And I just felt super deflated because I was super excited. I thought, hey, they're going to recognize me. And then they did. And that was nice, but that wasn't commensurate to what I felt I'd done. Yeah. And, you know, as I look back on that, there's two things. Either one, they didn't know what I'd done, or two, they didn't value it, or three, actually, I guess the third thing is they didn't want to encourage it. And so what I learned is that as a developer, you got to set boundaries. And the company's not going to value your time as much as you do. So that was one thing I pulled away from that small consulting company. As well as, I do want to say, ton of friends. I still hang out with people that I met at that company. And for developers, I think finding a way to keep in touch with your network is going to pay dividends over your career. It certainly has with mine.
Yeah, that's a cool thing to think about now, even with, because like, so for instance, I just joined a remote company. So it's even different where my, cause I'm used to like, so there's like a lot of the time, your coworkers are like co-located with you. Especially like I worked at like a few agencies as well. And I think it's a great start. And I remember being close to all of my coworkers. I think a lot of it was because we were like physically close to each other. We were talking and hanging out. We'd go out after work. Sometimes we'd go out on the weekends on occasion. You know, the company could do socials. I think it's like, I'm interested to see, I mean, I'm curious how you, have you transitioned like that, keeping in touch with people and networking and, you know, getting to maintain those connections long-term with and friendships just in general. Like, how do you, have you transitioned that online now? Have you started to build like.
So you're saying for the people that I'm at the company I'm working at now, or the people that I've worked with recently when
I'm thinking like, if you have friends that you've worked with that have even just, cause over the course of the years, people move on, people move to different places. Like, have you found that you've been able to keep up with people that weren't necessarily, let's say, in the same city? And like, I think that might be relevant now, just especially cause it's like a lot of people are probably considering moves, or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had the luxury of being in the same spot essentially for 20 years. I've been in Boulder, even though I've worked for companies in Denver and companies in San Francisco. I've really focused on that. So I guess, you know, the experience I've had is that when I tended to work for remote companies, I tended to try to dig into my local community a lot more. And so join meetups, help organize meetups, when I was contracting and I was super disconnected from the companies I worked for, I did a stint in the 2000s, about 7 years of contracting. I actually started up with a group of friends, just a regular lunch, and they were all contractors too. And so we'd all get together physically. So, you know, I think that you can absolutely build strong relationships online, and you can maintain them. I think that there's value in that, but two things. One is, I think the strongest relationships are the ones that start physically, right? Where you get to know the people in person, and for a remote company, that can just be an onsite, right? That's a great way to kind of kickstart those relationships. Totally. And the second point, I think, is that the online relationships that you create that tend to get kind of weaker are still valuable because they're helpful. They can be kickstarted again very easily, right? We all have those people in our lives that you can send an email to and they're happy to hear from you and you're happy to, you know, catch up with them and they'll be in different cities and communities. So they'll have access to different opportunities too. So.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, for sure. And so then I guess after the agency, is that when you decided to get into contracting?
Yep. So I contracted for a while and then I worked at a small real estate brokerage as kind of part of their tech team. Contracted again, and then co-founded a startup. And that was where I was the CTO as well. And so I just want to be super clear here that I've hung out with a lot of CTOs. Well, not a lot, but some. And there's just this huge spectrum, right? Like a CTO at a startup, like I was, where it's two or three people and you're super in, you know, front of the code, in front of customers, is just a far different experience than a CTO at a 200 person company or 20,000 person company, where you're much more strategic, you're much more thinking about building teams, thinking about, you know, big picture visionary technology. So I can definitely talk to the startup CTO piece. I can't really speak to the, you know, the bigger picture, like visionary CTO.
Definitely. I think a lot of the folks that are listening to this might be interested in like getting into their own startup or like working in smaller companies. Cause I know that, so like Toronto is a lot of the listeners are in Toronto and Toronto has a pretty small, like growing now, much bigger than it was a few years ago ecosystem. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of like self-starters and I feel like a lot of people are starting businesses right now. So I'd be curious, like, so how did the startup come to be? And like, did you meet co-founders and like work together initially? Did you build it? Did you get hired on? Like, how did that actually occur?
Yeah, no, it's great. It's fun story to talk about. So it's a startup called The Food Corridor, and they're still going on. I'm still a happy cheerleader for them and own some of the company. And so I had been contracting for a little bit and was looking for kind of my next thing. And, you know, I could have kept contracting, but I was on AngelList and this very interesting job opportunity came by. It was for the co-founder position. So my co-founder had deep domain expertise in the area. She was working on her PhD dissertation around local food systems. And she'd done some work around proving out the concept. And I would say that's one thing I would definitely advise to every person who's thinking about being a CTO-ish or a founding engineer person, is you want to test your co-founder. And it's not, you don't need to be confrontational about this, but the honest truth is that ideas are very easy and execution's hard, and you are giving up significant opportunities by joining a startup in terms of joining, I think Shopify's in Toronto, right?
Is that the big one? Based out now, yeah. I think they were from Montreal or something, but
okay. But I mean, there are definitely big companies out there that are happy to give you a nice stable salary.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. And, in Toronto and elsewhere in the world, and especially now with remote working, you know, you don't have to be in the city, but so, and I kind of just want to rant on this on a local community Slack, because someone came in and was like, "Hey, I'm looking for someone. I have this great idea that I think really has legs." And I said, "Yes, you and everybody else." maybe not everybody else, but the point is that I think you should be a little bit cynical. And if you are listening to this and you are a business person looking for a founder, or you have friends who are doing this, I think it's very easy for well, I should be careful here, not very easy for a business person to prove out their ideas, but very possible. So there are things you can do, like talking to customers, building no-code solutions, you know, manual processes, and all those things my co-founder did before I came on board. And that made it much easier for me to say, okay, I'm going to forego a significant salary and spend down my savings to help make this work. And so
that makes perfect sense. I love that. I just wanted to I think it's really cool because I think there's also a counter side to that where it's like, if you're the executor, like you're really great at like executing on someone's vision. It's easy to forget that all of that stuff that, you know, the customer interviews, the marketing, the feedback, like actually going out there, testing the market, doing the financials, like figuring out the business model, all of that is like, it's not secondary. It's like it all has to happen at the same time as the development. And I think like, you know, I'm in the same mindset where if I was joining a company, like I'd be trying to code, like, I mean, it's hard to force myself to take a step back and not try to code right away. And so I love that. It's like, the two of you basically balance out that pair where she takes care of all of the, like she actually has the vision and all of that stuff. And then you can collaborate on that. I think that's really key for not being like, I think like some developers, I mean, it's easy to be a developer and think like, oh, if I can get it built, then like I could just do it myself. There's a whole other side to it where you really need a partner in every engagement. So you were saying, sorry.
No, that's so true. And honestly, I think I was really important to the initial success of the company, but once you get to a certain stage, the vision and the knowledge of the domain are more important than the actual technical execution, right? Like I chose to develop the application Rails, but it could have been developed in PHP or anything else by a lot of other people. You know, I had the right risk profile, but I think that her vision and her just being really, really close to the customer made it a successful startup, because I've definitely been part of, I think I counted one time, 3 or 4 other startups. And a lot of them, you know, it was a bunch of cool code that was written, and then it's like by the side of the road because the market wasn't there. And she had the vision to identify the market. And to be honest, we pivoted once. We originally were going to be a kind of Airbnb for commercial kitchen space. And then we realized that two-sided markets are hard. Two-sided markets are very hard. And so we tried to think of what we would do with just kind of single player mode is the term I've heard bandied about. And I think I might've written this document up, but you know, she definitely validated it. And we ended up building a SaaS application for commercial kitchens. And like I said, it's still going strong. It's provided a ton of value to the people who are using it. We were able to raise prices multiple times. And that was the most fun part of the startup for me, was actually just being so close to the customer. I remember there were times when a customer would file a bug, and then, you know, in a day or two, I would be able to fix it and push it out, and they would be amazingly thankful. One of the anecdotes I want to say about that is that when you're starting out, especially as a developer, I think you have a heightened sense of the quality that your users are going to expect. And I don't think you should assume that that's always the case, because there was times when we pushed out something that frankly I was a little bit embarrassed by. Like it was a little cruddy, it wasn't beautiful, and our users, especially the early adopters, were, you know, just said, oh my god, this is amazing, this is so much better than what we had, because they were comparing it to manual stuff or Excel or Google spreadsheets that they were like patching together, and we presented a unified solution, even it wasn't beautiful, as beautiful as it could be. There's that phrase, you know, you gotta, if you wait till you're not a little embarrassed, you're probably shipping too late.
Definitely, like, ship fast. I love that. Cool. And then so after the food corridor, what did you end up doing? How did that, you decided to take on a new challenge, go independent? What happened?
Yeah. So, you know, how do I put this? I think after a couple of years, it was time for me to move on, for a number of reasons that I you know, rather not go into. They weren't, that's definitely
yeah,
personal.
Sorry. I did not mean to get into that way.
Okay. No, it's more like it was time for, it wasn't like I had like a big blow up fight with Ashley, my co-founder. It was just more right. like, you know, I've done what I can and this is, I can see where this is going and this isn't where I want to go. Right. And like I said, I need to be careful here about like non-disclosures. I'm still a happy participant in the company and I'm still cheering them on. And I think their mission is great and they've continued to grow. So I ended up taking a job at another agency, actually with some people that I'd worked with in the past. And then after a year and a half, so there, I had an opportunity to join a startup as a dev advocate, developer advocate. And that was really cool. They were a startup out of San Francisco. It was my first experience with a kind of really well-funded startup. And about 6 weeks after I joined, they actually pivoted and the CEO left who hired me. And I like to say that in the 8 months I was there, I had three bosses and four jobs because things were shifting around so much. And they laid me off in March. And I joined my current position where I'm my official title is head developer relations, but I'm really the dev advocate there. So I know you want to talk a little bit about like how I got into dev advocacy and like yeah. why I thought it was good.
I would love to hear how it's different between dev advocacy and working as an independent like contributor or as a developer on the team. It seems really interesting.
Sure. So, I mean, I guess the first thing I would say is there's this spectrum of dev advocacy, right? There's, or developer relations. And there are people who do, you know, huge talks. There are people who do videos and live streaming. There are people who do writing. There are people who do example applications, people who maintain SDKs, people who are really focused on community and community building and events. So, you know, I can only talk to my experience, which has been at those two different companies, both of whom were relatively small. Like I have not had dev advocate experience at a place like Twilio, which I think would be a totally different experience. But you know, it's really, for me, it's like a dream job because I'm splitting my time between customer support, like helping out customers and debugging their issues. I'm doing coding. So I do a bunch of example applications. I do writing. And so these are blog posts and documentation. And then I also have been doing more videos because it seems like that's a way that newer developers tend to want to consume content. So we've been trying to do that too. And so, the beautiful thing is, I think there's something really lovely about being an IC and like taking a ticket and like pointing it out and, you know, building out a really great piece of code that's unit tested and integrated and documented, and then kind of handing it off seeing it get shipped and watching your users use it. I think that's a fun thing to be, a fun place to be. But it's also really fun to just be bouncing around a lot and have direct customer interaction, but at the same time, be able to step back and say, well, strategically, what kind of documentation is going to help people achieve their goals? What's the biggest lever we can use to get people to find out about our product? So,
yeah, definitely. And like, I think with anything that's like used by developers, especially, it's, you really want to like know how to use it, and it's, everyone learns in a different way, and it's hard to like document that. Do you do a lot of speaking engagements and things like that as a result, or is that and I'm curious how you balance that with your personal brand, because we can get into the book that you released, which seems really interesting and very apt for my audience. So,
yeah. So as far as speaking goes, you know, I had a conversation about that when I took this job, and you know, there's been some, obviously the current pandemic situation has changed things a bit, but honestly, I've had a lot of fun just talking to meetups. So I've probably done 7 or 8 meetups. I found one presentation that the CEO had put together and I kind of took it and put my spin on it. And I've given this presentation about JSON web tokens all around the US, and I think I've talked to a couple, a Canadian meetup and a couple in Europe. So, and one in Israel, actually. So it's been, that's the silver lining of the pandemic, is that I can just email people and be like, hey, you know, does this work with your schedule? And there, I think, to your original point about kind of community building online, I think people are realizing we're in for this for the long haul, and they're looking for speakers. So to your audience, if anyone is looking to speak, actually, I'll put a pitch for, I help organize the Boulder Ruby meetup. So if you want to talk about Ruby, we are looking for speakers, and we've definitely had people from outside of the Boulder, Denver area come talk to us. So
that's awesome. I'll definitely include that in the show notes. Yeah, cool. And so, yeah, and then I guess my follow-up, so if you're doing, so I know that you do your blog and things that's external. I mean, you don't have to go into detail, I guess, but how do you like think about, or you could talk about how you delineate between, you know, your work blog, like, you know, your kind of contributions at work and your personal branding? Because I think that it sounds to me like it could get mixed, but I imagine that if you're putting out your own content regularly, I'm just curious about how the two interplay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is to have a conversation with it about your, have a conversation with it. That doesn't make any sense. To have a conversation about it with the person who's hiring you. I think that you probably have the same issue, right? Like in terms of this podcast and thinking about like, where do you break things apart? And I think that for developer advocacy, there's actually, you kind of want someone to have a presence, right? When you get hired as a developer advocate, actually one of the dev advocates that was hired at the previous company that I worked at, she came in with some domain expertise and a large number of Twitter followers. And I think there were other reasons why she was hired. She was an excellent choice to hire, but that certainly didn't hurt. So if you're interested in, I think that having this external brand is actually helpful for a dev advocate, or in a way that it might not be so helpful for an IC, someone just coding. As far as kind of how I break things down, you know, I just try to like, work time is for work, and I do other stuff out of hours. So that's kind of the choice I made.
For sure. And then, could we talk briefly about your blog and the things that you do outside, and then how that relates to your book? Actually, I guess we could just talk about the book.
I'm happy to talk about the blog too. I mean,
yeah, I'm curious if those built into each other is where I was going with that, but I also don't want to lead the witness.
No, totally. Yeah. So the kind of the genesis of the book is directly really super closely tied to the blog. So what happened is I wrote an ebook in about 2012, 2013 about a technology called Cordova, or PhoneGap is the term, is another way it's called. I don't know. Are you familiar with that? I see you smiling.
Yeah, I love it. I got started with that like shortly after doing like some Angular development. So it's really fun to hear that I'm excited to hear what you have to say.
Cool. Yeah. It was like a 45 page ebook. It was about a specific aspect of Cordova development. You can automate things kind of like with Git hooks. You can do stuff with Cordova hooks, and it really showed and I did it by writing like 10 or 12 pieces on my blog, and a different blog than the Letters to New Developer blog, my personal kind of more DS blog. And then I kind of took that down and turned it into a book, and I self-published it. And that taught me a lot of things. It taught me how to self-publish, some of the marketing pieces that are really, really important for something like a book to succeed. It also taught me that being an author is not a way to riches. And the last thing I learned was, if you write a book about technology, you better be darn committed to that technology, or it's going to get out of date really quickly. And so I was in the latter camp. I actually stopped using Cordova shortly after I wrote the book. And so it's still out there. You can still buy it, but you probably don't want to because it hasn't been updated for 7 years or 8 years. So when I kind of, when my life changed again and I had a little more time, I decided I want to write another book, but I decided I wanted something to be more evergreen. And so I started up this blog, Letters to New Developer. And I said to myself, well, write it for a while, see how much fun you're having. And, you know, you might be able to do a book out of it in the future. But, you know, if you just, all you do is write and it's evergreen content that's helpful to people, then that is valuable in and of itself. And so I started writing and I ended up writing about 150 posts. And some of them were like a minute read, some of them were 4 minute reads, but the format was fun for me because it was basically like a letter to my younger self or to new developers right now. And it was things that I thought were true that weren't, or things that I thought weren't important that actually were important. And I ended up writing the book, which I basically took all those letters, I collated them, I edited them. I had got permission from some guest authors, because one of the nice things about having this platform is that I now am to the point where I'm asking people to write guest letters and they are happy to do that, right? And whether they are talking about kind of, I have one that's scheduled about someone talking about what project managers want junior developers to know, or people from kind of totally different backgrounds. So I got that put together and I wrote a book proposal first. And then I got the book proposal accepted. And then I kind of did this kind of cleansing process or gathering process. I ended up writing new letters too. So it's not just letters from the blog. And the ones that are from the blog have been heavily revised. But yeah, so that's kind of, and then, you know, I mean, it turns into a book that, again, the whole point here, and I think that anybody listening who wants to be an author should think about it, books are great for credibility and they're great for helping people. They're definitely not going to make you money, right? The amount of time and effort you spend putting a book together, if you just, you know, sold your hours as a contractor or someone moonlighting, you'll make far more money. I don't even know what the percentage is, 99.9% of the time.
I think there's like a... I mean, I see it on, like, for instance, like Twitter, people will like start selling a book. And then within like 24 hours, they've sold, you know, 30,000 copies. And I think there's like a dream of doing that, but maybe it's not the reason to write a book. Cause like, I mean, chances are you have to like do a lot of legwork to get to that point too. I think I love the idea of like writing the blog with kind of the intention of eventually creating some sort of book, and like that you themed it. I also just wanted to say, so I started blogging recently using like Medium, and it's so cool when you get like a little, like you get like 100 views and you get like a little, like a dollar or something like that. And I definitely spent, you know, like I think the $10 I make off an article is a little lower than like an hourly rate would be if I got a job as a dishwasher or something. But it's just so rewarding to like have people read your stuff. But I love that you took that and turned it into like an actual, like you intended to like eventually create some sort of product or something out of it. Like it's really interesting. Do you have like an email newsletter and stuff like that to go along with the blog? Like, how do you market it or get it in front of people?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you can subscribe to get the new letters in your inbox every week. So that is kind of set up automatically. I use WordPress.com and MailChimp to do that. And then the other kind of, honestly, you know, I auto tweet that. I auto tweet new letters. But that hasn't really been a big, you know, a huge source of subscribers. The thing that I've found that has been probably the most effective is really online communities. So Reddit, Lobsters, Hacker News. And, you know, I think there you kind of, I should be careful. I actually kind of got dinged on Lobsters for being too self-promotional. So I think you want to be very aware of the ethics of your community. So don't just be like a self-promoter. And I definitely, on all those communities, I make an effort to not just promote my own stuff. I want to, if I find other interesting things, whether it's from friends or anything else, I will share that as well. But they each have different kind of tolerances, right? Reddit is more tolerant than lobsters and Hacker News, you know, you're basically screaming into the void and hoping that someone picks something up occasionally. And I've had a couple of posts that I have posted go to the front page of Hacker News, which is really awesome. But I think that it's less about, so you don't get a bunch of people subscribing, but you do get some awareness. Like, I've actually had people that I would consider to be, I don't want to say they're not famous, but they're more prominent than I am, who've said, oh yeah, I saw that post of yours on Hacker News. The other thing I've done is actually, and this is a good thing to just remember if you're thinking about any kind of book, is start with the audience you want to approach and think about how you get to that audience before you write a single line, unless you just want to write a blog and, you know, have fun doing it. But if you're actually trying to make it something that you can make some money on or reach people, start with the audience in mind first, just like you would do for a business, right? And so boot camps have been a huge, a very easy way for me to market my book and my blog. And I've given, I don't know, a number of talks to boot camp grads or
okay. people in boot. And do you just volunteer, like email them up and say, hey, I'd love to do a little chat. I've got this book that would be relevant to people, or the blog that would be relevant to people. I've got a lot of experience. It's really, and do you do a lot of this online? Cause I'm really keen on this, actually. This is really selfish, but I'm trying to do a lot of this stuff myself, you know, like trying to figure out how to even just generate ideas around content. And like you said, it's, you know, I could only write so many, 5 minute long essays about running and be as poetic as a shoe. But, eventually I got to write for a person. So I'm curious, cause like what I see as being like, oh, this is going to hit, this is a valuable piece of information, typically does like, okay. And then things that like I wrote a year or two ago to myself, like notes that I was like, all right, I'm going to turn that into a blog post and just share it. And it's like, oh, how I write commits, like that's the one that people like, right? It's hard to tell. So I'm curious how you go about sourcing this information.
So is your question, how do I source ideas that are interesting, or that ideas that I think are going to succeed, or what?
How you source most of your ideas that end up working. Like, how do you find typically when things work, do you think it comes from other people or from a mixture? I know it's a very esoteric question.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a couple of different components of, I think, a really successful post. I mean, the first is just plain luck, right? Like that definitely plays a role. I think persistence around sharing it can play a role in helping accelerate that luck. I think the quality of the writing, I think that the topic is important too, but those other three factors are things that you can kind of make methodical. The content, I'm a huge fan of, again, I kind of put myself in my shoes, right? And I think, hey, what would I have wished a senior developer would have told me? Or even better is you see somebody ask a question, or you see somebody make a comment that you think is perceptive, and you can riff off of that, right? So I often troll Twitter or Slacks and look for questions that junior developers ask, or statements people are saying about, you know, junior developers or new developers. Juniors, a little bit demeaning sometimes, I think that, but and then kind of riff on those. So to be honest with you, some of my two kind of most popular blog posts that I wrote, I definitely had some people write some really great ones, some guest posters, but the ones that most popular ones I wrote were avoid working alone, which is basically advice that I think when you're especially a new developer, you really should be on a team, even if it's a team of other new developers, because you'll level up quicker. And the other one is the surprising number of programmers who can't program, which was a riff on a Hacker News comment that I kind of expanded out. And so I don't really like to write, because of the way that this is, and like the fact that I'm writing a lot in my day job, that I'm trying to like write sexy stuff. I'm trying to write stuff that gets picked up, right? Yeah. I tend to reserve letters to new developer for just kind of my musings. And again, I think I probably get 30 or 40, unless I'm like promoting it actively, I get 30 or 40 people just stumbling on it every day. day. And,
wow,
you know, think about that, right? Like I will come back to that in a second, because that wow is an interesting point. But, you know, just the blessing to be able to publish something for essentially free that 30 or 40 people might read in a day, right, is just, we live in a wonderful time. But when you said wow, were you impressed by how little or how much that was?
Like the consistency, because like none of my, or like Medium, I get some views. Mm-hmm. Because of the community and whenever they like share it. But mm-hmm. when I post on my own blog, I get some, like, I think Chinese bots sometimes, like scrolling through like Xandu or something. That's about it.
Yeah, that's not super heartwarming, right? To have a bot. No, I mean, I will say, and actually I wrote this in the book because I talk about blogging as a way to like reinforce your thinking and to show, not tell, how good you are as a developer, how well you can communicate. But when I started Letters to New Developer, the first month I had more posts than I had views. I think I wrote 8 posts and I had 5 people who weren't me view it. And basically for the first 3 months, I had like 20 or 30 people a month. And so I always tell people that really you have to commit for 6 months before you, and some kind of regular cadence before you can kind of see anything with blogging. And that was certainly true for me.
Okay. Yeah. I like that. That makes a lot of sense. Like, it's good advice for anyone getting started. And I think, like, I mean, I think getting into like anything like this, I wish I'd done it so much earlier. Like I've been literally publishing blog posts that I wrote 2 or 3 years ago on the job, and those are doing okay. And I'm like, oh, if I had just published that when, like when I did that, you know?
Yeah.
But it's confidence, I guess, or I was just embarrassed, I guess, but.
So I'm actually interested about, like, were you embarrassed because you didn't feel it was high enough quality, or because what you were doing wasn't interesting, or why were you like hesitant?
I think at the time I wasn't. So like, I was kind of like in the midst of, you know, I'd had a few jobs, but I wasn't like, didn't want to consider myself like an expert. I didn't want to look like a show off or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like telling people how to do things when, you know, I've been working for a few years in an agency. And before that I was freelancing, right? Like, what do I know? So I think it was more in line with that. And then like when I reread it and then touched it up a little bit, and then I was like, you know, this is okay. Like it's just a tiny little piece of advice. I think what also helped was seeing like DevTO take mm-hmm. off and mm-hmm. like how simple some of the content can be. Mm-hmm. And like, I know like really senior engineers who have been have been into the industry like yourself for like years. And you know, they're not, it's not like everyone's posting a manifesto or something like every week, right? It's some blog posts are just meant to be a simple idea. I think that was like, it was just a bit of a shift in my ego, I guess.
I mean, one thing that I've definitely struggled with, and I've talked to other people who kind of have blogged and have struggled with blogging, is that kind of idea of perfection, right? Like that they really need to, and I'm not saying you had this, but like, I definitely know people who had, they don't want to post anything that they can't stand behind 100%, that they haven't, you know, made authoritative. And I would just say that two things. One, I would say there's value in just the act of creation and your thinking about it and your reasoning about something. There's just value if no one else ever sees that, right? But you'll do better when you put it out in the world because it'll make you just take that extra step. Second thing is that the honest truth is a lot of blogs don't ever get read. And so if you're afraid of like your boss finding it and like saying, hey, why didn't you use the Oxford comma? You know, it's just unlikely to ever happen. But you do have serendipitous things, and Google is a wonderful thing. And the more I blog, because I've been actually blogging since 2003 on my own private blog, you know, and I've had, how do I put this? I've never had a job offer come because of a blog, but it definitely has served as a credibility marker. Again, kind of the same way as a book, but lower impact on your life. So if you can write, if you can carve out the time to do it, Medium makes it easy. WordPress.com makes it easy. I just don't think there's anything. And the last thing I would say, because I can tell that I'm kind of rambling about this, is that you may think that, oh gosh, I've just been a freelancer and I've only, worked at agencies for a couple of years. What do I have to say? Like, to someone who's never been in the industry or to someone who has only been working for 6 months, what you have to say is gold, and let them make that decision about the value of it rather than you kind of saying no to yourself before you even give it a chance.
That's awesome. I love that. Thank you. I guess we're kind of running up on time. So I typically try to ask one last rambly question as I do. I just like to fit all the details in and see where it goes, you know? I don't have a plan, but if you were to like look back, this is a bit of a different question. I still think it would be interesting. You could pick whatever point in your career this would be, but like if you could go back and like talk to somebody at like a pinnacle point where you had to make a big decision, or you had to like have some sort of advice would have made a huge advantage, either like made it easier for you to continue on the path you already took, or to take an opportunity that you think would have been really cool and turn it around. Like, what would be that advice to that person who's like maybe a little unsure?
Can I give two answers to that?
Definitely.
So the first, and kind of the more conventional thing, is I actually almost went into the Peace Corps by after school instead of taking that job at that web consulting company. And I think I would have had a different life. I think it would have been an amazing adventure and experience. And I wish someone had, I didn't choose that for a number of reasons, but the biggest one was fear. And I would just say to that younger Dan, like, you think you have a lot riding on you right now, but wait 20 years and you have a family and a mortgage and you'll seem free as a lark. So take those opportunities. And the second thing is actually related. You know, I spent a lot of time kicking around when I was contracting in the 2000s, and I had a lot of fun. I worked about 30 hours a week. I made, you know, good money. I was fine. I was able to save, but I discovered the idea of self-publishing, the idea of kind of e-courses, the idea of passive income, like afterwards, right, in the 2010s. And so, you know, when you're young and single, I don't want to be a crotchety old man, but I think that I didn't realize, so I'm not going to say you here because it's all about me. I didn't realize how much free time I actually had, right? Because it seemed like it was packed with social events and hiking and trips and stuff. And then you have a family, or you get other obligations, right? Not necessarily family, but other obligations. And suddenly that time gets squeezed. And I kind of wish I'd spent more time building assets beyond my blog that would actually have income, or at least trying to do that. And again, that was 2000. So it was a different, like, AWS hadn't started. There were other things that Stripe hadn't started. But if you're in that space right now, again, it's really tough, Matthew, because I think that it's very easy when you're older to look back and say, oh, I should have taken more risk. But then I don't look at what I'm doing right now and say, I'm going to take more risk now, right? It's very easy for me to look back and say, oh, I should have taken more risk then. But I didn't, and I'm not taking that same advice now. So actually, might be an interesting thing for you to do, the next interview you do, is like, if you ask someone the advice they would give to their younger selves, then say, well, why aren't you taking that advice right now? Right?
Yeah.
So
anyway. I love that. I'm going to turn that around next time.
Totally.
I love it. Thank you so much. Well, thank you for doing this. This has been really fun.
Yeah, it's been a delight. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'll put everything in the show notes as well. I say show notes, it's just me typing stuff out before I post. But I'll try to link out to your LinkedIn profile, Twitter, anywhere else that you want people to check out. Obviously the book and everything, if they want to continue following you.
Sure. I think LinkedIn or Twitter are two great ways. make sure that you got the book website. And yeah, I'd love to, if you have questions about the book process, if you have questions about your new development career, I'd love to hear from people and I'd love to help connect folks. So please reach out to me.
And definitely volunteer for the Boulder Ruby meetup if you know Ruby. I don't, but I would if I could.
I have other opportunities too. Ooh. So if you, I will say that like, I know people who run the JavaScript meetup. I know people who run the DevOps meetup. And I will say that I think that the best way to learn something is to teach it. Mm. And it can be really petrifying to stand up in front of a group of people and talk. But meetups are some of the friendliest groups of people. So. Sorry, I had to squeeze in one more final pitch there. Sorry.
Oh, I love it. Thank you. I needed something like that. That's perfect.
Cool.
Cool.